Hello and welcome to Witch Bitches Review. I'm an evil 16th century warlock with a wicked grudge against you, and I want you dead so bad that I'm gonna kill you later. Phoenix Arcana Lightwood.
And I'm a dead pilgrim so desperate to get dick down that I fucked a witch hunter, Siren Rex Fry. This is the podcast where two actual witches analyze and review representations of witchcraft in media and pop culture.
Today, we're talking about Charmed again.
Yay!
We're doing season 1, episode 9, The Witch is Back.
The title of the episode is a reference to the 1974 Elton John hit song, The Bitch is Back, which is basically about Elton John being in a bad mood, and he iconically describes it as his theme song.
According to IMDb, this episode ranked 8.3 out of 10 and is the one where Prue is attacked by a warlock from the past, but Phoebe calls on an ancestor to help protect her sisters, and Piper works up her courage to ask Leo out. This episode was written by Cheryl J. Anderson and directed by Richard Denault.
That description is like a little ridiculous. I mean, like, Piper asking Leo out is like such a minor plot point here. And it's just sort of like, Prue and Phoebe were dealing with serious matters, and Piper was worried about dating.
I mean, I feel like that's almost the formula at this point. One of them is always concerned about a boy. The other ones are actually dealing with real fucking shit, you know? I agree with you, though. Like, that was not a pivotal point in the episode.
It didn't seem like a pivotal point to me. Like, yeah, it happened, but okay.
I love this episode so much. I think this one and the next one are, like, quintessential Charmed. They just feel so much like the show we know and love. It's just the right amount of camp. The fashion is good. The dialogue is witty. It's self-aware, but, like, also serious in the right moments. It just checks all of the boxes for me. And I think it's really well written and super well acted. I love Melinda. And I'm really sad that we don't see her anymore after this one.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is also one of my favorite episodes. And I think the actress who plays Melinda did a really great job. Her name is Tyler Layton. And interestingly, this is the last credited role that she had in her really short-lived television career, which only lasted from 1995 to 1998. It's too bad because I think she had a lot of potential. This episode has a really great balance of comedy, drama, and mysticism. Like Phoenix said, basically checks all the boxes of Charmed. I think Melinda and the actress who played her are a big part of that. And I agree. I would have loved to see Melinda in future episodes the way that we kept seeing Mom and Grams in future episodes. I think that would have been great. And it seems like a missed opportunity that it didn't happen because I think this episode is really great. It is more than a little contrived that the villain doesn't just, like, kill them all and win the day. It seems like it would have been soups easy for him if he was, like, actually trying. But, you know, it's the Charmed Ones show, so.
I definitely agree. It made Matthew seem very incompetent.
He was totes incompetent.
Yeah, like, there were a few times in the episode where I was like, this dude is dumb. I don't know how he got Melinda in trouble because this guy is stupid.
Yeah, well, Puritans, you know. Okay, so our episode opens in Salem, and, you know, words on the screen tell us that it's 1692. A blonde woman, who we will soon learn is Melinda Warren, is being held captive in a room that is way, way super nicer than any witch cell in anywhere ever. Like, she's basically in, like, a Puritan hotel room, but they want you to believe that it's a witch's cell. A warlock named Matthew Tate comes in, and they talk about how they used to be banging, but Matthew just wanted to steal her powers, and Melinda is like, that is so fucked. She's mad, so she uses a spell to curse Matthew into being trapped inside her locket.
That, I don't even know how one would go about doing something like that, to be honest with you. That's crazy to me. And honestly, like, you're right, the room that she was in was very nice. It kind of looked like a stable to me. Like, it looked like she was just, like, being kept with the horses.
Well, okay, she had, like, a candle sconce that was lit like mounted on the wall.
I didn't notice that.
That is not the conditions that they kept accused witches in Salem, okay? It is not. She would have been in like a dark windowless room that was maybe like 3 foot by 3 foot. Like, that's how it was.
Oh, yikes. Yeah, she had to get some shit done, so they put her in, you know, maybe she used a spell to get a nicer room.
I guess. They just needed an environment for their little lover squirrel.
So we transition into the next scene after that, and what a surprise. The exact item that gets the story in motion ends up on Prue's desk. What? How? I found it kind of interesting that we see Rex trying to open the locket himself for just like half a second. I didn't notice it the first time I watched the episode, but when it like pans up, he's like struggling with the locket.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's supposed to indicate to us that only someone descended from Melinda can open the locket. So he's brought the surprise, surprise, the very same locket that Matthew was cursed in. He has brought it to Prue.
Well, you know, he brought her, like, a whole bunch of crap to analyze, but she goes for the locket first.
Yeah, so there's, like, all of this stuff, and then I assume she's probably just drawn to it because of magic. And she opens the locket, and it releases Matthew. And he comes out, and he's like, at last! Freedom! My balls were getting so sweaty in there.
Ew. Phoenix, ew.
He has put together that she is descended from Melinda Warren because she freed him from the locket. Prue throws him across the fucking room, but her appetite for destruction and violence has not paid off in this particular scenario.
Just the one time,
because he just, like, straight up turned into Rogue from the X-Men and stole her powers. Like, so he now has her power, and he learns that her last name is Hallowell. And he's, like, blinking all over the room, and Prue's like, what the fuck is that? I've never seen anybody do that before. That's crazy. I'm gooped and gagged. And then he fucking breaks her window and jumps out. Honestly, overkill. If he can blink wherever he wants, why did he need to jump out the window?
Because they needed the lamest possible excuse to get Andy involved.
So after that scene, we get the opening credits. And I have a question for you. Do you have any idea when they started doing the San Francisco montages in every episode? Because it's kind of sparse throughout season one, and then I think in season two it's like every episode for the rest of the show.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure exactly at what point it started. It's possible it's this one.
It's been in the episode where there's been like multiple guest stars that they do them, and I think it's just to like get that like post-credits out of the way. But after this, it's like in every single one. So
I do enjoy the shots of San Francisco in the show. I think they're great at, like, you know, describing the setting, and a lot of times they're really beautiful. Mm-hmm. As the series goes on, some of the opening credit shots are really, really beautiful. In particular, season 6, I feel like, has really great opening shots of San Francisco. Season 2, however, is the same shots for 22 episodes straight. It is. You're gonna get so sick of that damn trolley.
It's just to remind the viewer, like, hey, by the way, we're in San Francisco.
And by the way, there's the same red-ass trolley. This one has a really great cover of In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins, and I fucking love this song, and I think this version is really pretty. You know, couple that with the shots of San Francisco, and it's just one more really great charmed opener. I'm telling you, they're just really good. Why exactly are homicide detectives investigating a broken window?
Yeah, exactly. I had the same thought.
Like, Daryl and Andy are on the scene, and they're like, look at all this broken-ass glass and no dead bodies. Yeah, we are on the case. And then Daryl's all like, well, do we even know whose office it is? And Andy's like, yeah, it's Prue's. And he's got this, like, I fucking told you so look on his face.
Oh my god, Andy is such an asshole in this episode.
I'll tell you what he is a dweeb. He's a dweeb.
Not hot. Not hot. Not hot. I would not fuck Andy in this episode.
Well, that's a welcome change. So back at Hallowell Manor, Piper is annoying Leo while he works on their plumbing. Their plumbing is fucked, like, all the time. Like, guys, deal with that. Okay.
It's an old house. At
this point in time. I know, but just fix the plumbing or fuck Leo or something. I feel like Piper is like going through the walls, banging pipes with a wrench so she can get Leo back over there to stare at his D. There's this really awkward conversation where Phoebe pulls Piper aside and she's like, ask him out, you ugly spinster bitch. I'm going to refer to your vagina as a crab because that's flattering. I don't know. It's really weird.
It is really weird.
Show on prime time? Like, kids could be watching this.
Oh, I mean, I feel like that's why she said, like, crab and not...
Crab? Do you want to teach children that vaginas are crab-like? That I mean, a woman's flower is secretly a just pointy, pinching crustacean?
No. Obviously, no. But I feel like that's why she said crab and not, like, poos.
I don't know. That's weird. If my sister referred to my genitals as any kind of shellfish that dwells on the ocean floor, I would ask her not to refer to my vagina ever again.
There's a brief discussion about how it's okay for women to ask men out, and heterosexuality is just fucking exhausting.
Exhausting.
Ugh. I mean, I said in our last episode, like, I give zero fucks about straight people and their problems. And, I mean, maybe that alienates our straight listeners. I don't know. Sorry. You guys are boring. I don't care.
Okay. No. So that's not the direction I was trying to dig it in. But, you know, Phoenix is a heterophobe. We're working on it. It might be a lost cause. You know, people like to act like Charmed isn't all that feminist now, but for the 90s it was, I think. And, you know, they talked about just women's issues even in passing a lot. And this is one of them, where Piper has this old-fashioned traditional value of, like, I have to wait for the man to ask me out. And Phoebe is like, no, you don't, you stupid bitch. It's almost a new millennium.
Hard agree. Yeah, I feel like this show, I mean, we kind of called out some slut-shaminess that happened earlier this season, but I also feel like this show was really sex-positive for the 90s.
It was. It so was.
Which is cool. I'm into that. I'm just, mm-hmm. I wish there was better queer representation in it, but I guess we have the new one for that. Yeah. But Phoebe tries to dump a whole thing of tea on Leo, probably to get him to take his shirt off, and I would do the same thing. But Piper freezes the room and ruins the whole plan.
Seriously, magic is not intended to stop a male wet t-shirt contest, Piper. I'm gonna need you to check the Book of Shadows.
But Prue comes in and she's like, we have a problem. And then Phoebe and Piper are like, there's a person in here. And Prue's like, well, let's go upstairs then. I want to say, we made fun of the crab thing, but I really enjoy the banter between Phoebe and Piper. I feel like the sisterly chemistry is getting better and better and better every episode. And I mean, I know that there was a lot of like behind the scenes stuff that went on between the cast members, but I feel like they know each other a little better now and they're interacting with each other more. The chemistry between them doesn't feel as forced as it did.
Yeah. No, if anything, I think the chemistry between them is at its best at this point. Because a lot of this took place before the cast members maybe had little bits of falling out.
Yeah. So yeah. It definitely feels good, and they play off of each other pretty well.
That crab line just makes me cringe, okay?
It's a little much. It's kind of just like right there and open, you know?
Crab! I mean, I love crab, but it calls into question, like, is Leo going to be cracking Piper's vagina open with some kind of utensil and then eating it with, like, slop of butter? Is he going to be, like, squeezing a lemon wedge in there first? Is he going to have to wear a bib?
I don't have words for that. Let's move on.
So now Andy, ever the illustrious detective, is interviewing Rex and Hannah, and he is like, I am going to get to the bottom of whoever the fuck murdered your window. And Rex and Hannah are like, listen, we absolutely don't know anything and are in no way warlocks. Rex and Hannah get together after this silly interview, And they're, like, super pleased with themselves, except Hannah's kind of a bitch about it. Like, she is about everything. And they're basically just like, we did this on purpose. We're so happy that we got Prue to let the warlock out of the locket, and now we're gonna go look for him.
So they knew that Prue was a witch, but they were just not certain that she was a charmed one. Is that what we're meant to get from this?
Yeah, they were like, they put the locket in her path to, basically, because it's only supposed to react to, the charmed ones or Melinda Warren's lineage, basically. So when she touched it and the warlock came out, they were like, oh, we've proved the legend true.
See, I just was a little bamboozled by that because they knew that she was a witch and they were like fucking with her beforehand. And then they were like, the little witch is charmed. Duh, bitch. Like, we knew that. We've been new.
Well, we're the audience. We knew that. She didn't know that because she was really, really busy wrestling Prue over that goddamn sandwich. Hannah has a lot going on, okay? She's prioritizing.
There was a really cool, like, double entendre that Rex said when he was talking to Andy, and he was like, oh, believe me, Inspector, I really don't care about the window. I only care about Prue. Which is...
Your Rex accent is so on point.
Which is true. He only cares about Prue. That's not even really his auction house.
Yeah. He's like, obsessed with
me. Why are you so obsessed with me? That was neat to me that they put enough thought in it. I mean, maybe they didn't have enough. They put any thought into it at all, but I thought it was funny because it made sense. But so we're in the attic after Andy, the amazing detective, Sherlock Holmes extraordinaire, interviewed Rex and Hannah about the murdered window. The sisters are talking about Melinda Warren and how she was burned at the stake, which absolutely did not happen because they didn't burn people at the stake.
They didn't do
that in Salem. But Phoebe grabs the locket and has a premonition and sees Melinda cursing Matthew into the locket. And they're like, you can't see the past, you fucking screw up. And Phoebe's like, I really want to learn to fly. Which, you know, she does later. But how does that fucking make sense? I have never been comfortable with the fact that Phoebe gets a levitation power. How did we go from psychic to Wonder Woman? I don't understand.
So I don't know if this is connected or not. It's probably more likely that they just thought her levitation power would be cool since they also made her a martial artist. In season 3, when Phoebe starts levitating and Prue starts using telekinesis to basically do whatever the fuck she wants, was also the year that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was super popular.
I don't know what that is.
It's basically like this Asian action movie that involved a lot of those like flying around kind of stunts.
Oh, okay.
You might find this interesting. It's maybe not connected at all and maybe just some weird, random, stupid thing I put together. But in the book, Practical Magic, that the movie is based on, the book has two parts. And the first part is called Premonition, and the second part is called Levitation.
Oh.
So I don't know if that's connected.
It might be. I don't know that. See, at the point that that happens, Constance is no longer on the show. And I feel like after that point, they just didn't really put that much thought into anything that they did ever. So I don't know that that's connected. I thought maybe, and this is like a fan theory, that she got that power to fly from that dragon that one time in the end of season 2. And then the next season, she developed the power to fly. So maybe because she had that power for a hot second, it just like stuck around. I don't know.
I also sort of thought that maybe giving her the flight power in the season 2 finale was like a test of the levitation thing to see if they could feasibly do it for the rest of the show.
Solid point.
Anyway, so we're flashing back to Matthew now. And he, you know, goes into this lawyer's office, a lawyer named Halliwell, and just like kills him. A little anachronistic here, but Matthew finds this guy because he has a torn out phone book page with all the listings of Halliwell in San Francisco, and he uses this phone book page to navigate addresses around a modern day city he's never been to, which is pretty impressive for a guy who's from Salem 300 years ago where they didn't have phone books.
I mean, good point.
Yeah, and then just judging how, like, Matthew and Melinda spend the rest of the episode acting completely confounded by anything in the modern world.
Huh. That's very interesting. Huh. I mean, I'm not going to try to conflate it or, like, make it make sense because it doesn't. It's just a continuity error. But, like, maybe... I was just thinking maybe he can just, like, blink to all of the people. He doesn't have to know where he's going. He just has to know who he's going to.
I mean, okay, that's not a bad theory. That's not a bad explanation. I accept that. But I still don't know why he was like, ah, yes, this phone book that I probably found in a phone booth. Obviously, I understand.
Yeah, I don't know. That's really, that's really, really strange. But the sisters, we go back to the sisters. This is another one of those episodes where we bounce back and forth between what people are doing a whole bunch. But the sisters are researching Melinda in their Book of Shadows, and Piper reads about the warlock from some random other book. Where the fuck did that come from?
I don't know. I don't know why she was holding a book that wasn't the Book of Shadows and acting like it had information in it. It's kind of random.
I meant to do research on something that she said. She was talking about the pewter heart, but that was just, I think that's just the locket.
Yeah.
I wondered if it had any significance, and then I thought about it and I didn't care anymore, so I just moved on. But they go downstairs, and Prue sees Andy on TV at her workplace, because Leah was like, hey, Prue, look, your work's on TV. Their handyman is sitting on their couch watching TV.
Fix the damn pipes, Leo!
Like, do your job, bruh.
And then go to Red Lobster and eat Piper's pussy.
Andy miraculously jumps out of the TV and to their front door. And Phoebe goes out to stall him by lying her fucking ass off and not well.
Yeah, good for you, Phoebe. Be gay, do crime, lie to the cops.
And Andy reveals that Matthew has now killed someone, which we know, but the sisters do not know. And he's like, someone jumped out of Prue's window and killed a lawyer with your guys' last name, so I need to fucking talk to her and arrest her now. What the fuck, Andy? Stop being a dick.
I mean, it's suspicious, but where's your due process, honey? Okay.
He's so weird. He wants to arrest Prue so fucking bad in this episode, and then in the next one he's like, oh, I know you're not a criminal, baby. I know.
Well, they just broke up, so he's going through an emotional roller coaster. And because police officers just, I don't know, sometimes don't manage their feelings in the best way, he's, of course, using his position to terrorize his ex-girlfriend. I'm just saying.
You got a point. And so Phoebe's like, where's your warrant? And she goes back inside.
I really like that line. I did. She's just all like, where's your warrant? Smile. Wink. This is very fuck you.
It was good.
So anyway, so then Phoebe goes back inside and she's like, well, I ditched the fuzz. Anyway, let's do some necromancy. Let's summon Melinda Warren. And Piper and Prue were like, that sounds like evil devil magic. And Phoebe's like, well, I know the Book of Shadows better than you lazy bitches. So anyway, we're going to do it. It's going to be really easy. So the sisters, they cut their fingers and bleed into the locket. They put it in their cauldron and they say this super complicated, intricate spell. Melinda Warren, blood of our blood, we summon thee. No, really, that's literally it.
This is Misspelled, the segment where we critique the spells used by TV witches and talk about how an actual witch might do the same thing. And today we're going to be talking about ancestor worship and communing with your ancestors, and also some, like, blood magic and some ooky stuff. So let's get into it.
We could have gone more of a direction of, like, I don't know, like, doing a seance or something, or talked about, like, bringing things back to life. But I think there's a lot more time with that, and this is really the best chance that we're going to have to talk about ancestor work and ancestor worship on the show. So I'm really excited to be doing that with this episode, for sure.
So when approaching this episode, you and I had both said that we don't really do ancestor work in our practices. However, there are a lot of, like, traditions and spiritual paths where it's a core tenet. And I just want to, like, take a second to talk about ancestor work, before we get into all of the traditions and stuff, all of which are completely valid and, you know, do whatever you want. It's not my place to speak for all queer people, but I personally don't feel like a super strong connection to like family and like my lineage and things of that nature. I have a lot of family members that have crossed over, but I didn't necessarily have the best relationships with all those people in life. And in death, it's hard to find resolution for those issues. And I feel like I'm not the only queer person that feels that way. I'm not the only queer person that doesn't feel connected to their immediate family or hasn't been accepted by them or, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And I feel like some people may just not feel comfortable or just don't have the desire to work with their lineage. And so sometimes ancestor work doesn't have to be about your biological ancestors. You know, it can be anyone you had like great admiration for or dear friends or even like departed celebrities if you had like a deep connection to their work. Or, you know, speaking as queer people, you can connect to the queer people that came before us and made the life that we have possible. Just some food for thought before we get into this, because I felt, as I was trying to do research for this stuff, I felt very, like, othered by it almost, and it was something that I didn't really feel, or that I didn't expect to feel when approaching this. And I always knew that ancestor work made me a little uncomfortable, but I wasn't sure why until we approached this.
I mean, I think that's good. I mean, when we went into it, we both thought, you know, this will probably be a learning experience for both of us. And it was for you, just in an unexpected way.
Yeah.
I don't really do a lot of ancestor work either. And I definitely get where Phoenix is coming from. As a white queer person, I think if I look too far into my ancestry, I'm going to find some homophobes and some racists.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe you're not invited into my circle. Sorry. however, the one day that I do anything like ancestor work is Samhain. My coven celebrates Samhain, October 31st, Muggle Halloween, if you will, every year. And communing with the dead is basically the event of the day. We take it very seriously. We have a lot of traditions around it. And, you know, I do honor people in my family who have died, but it doesn't have to just be your blood family. And like Phoenix said, I don't think your ancestors necessarily have to be your blood ancestors. You can connect with, I don't know, say Marsha P. Johnson, who we honor at Samhain every single year, who was a Black trans woman who fought the police at Stonewall and created queer alliances and activist groups in New York City until she was murdered for doing so. Marsha P. Johnson was amazing and integral in the fight for queer rights in America. And while I have no blood relations to her, I will proudly claim her as my fucking queer ancestor.
Absolutely.
So ancestors do not just have to be your blood ties. I do honor Marsha P. Johnson at every single Samhain. Last year, we honored Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I talked to all of my dead cats from the past and my grandma Joanne. You know, like, it does. I'm just saying it can be eclectic. You know, your ancestors, in a sense, for you, can mean whatever feels right to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I do connect with my family on Samhain as well. Just because it's a good day to do it. And I do have family members on the other side, but it's kind of like a special event for me. I don't do ancestor veneration year round the way that some other practices do.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty common in especially more like Eastern countries. Ancestor veneration is a pretty common practice all the time. It's definitely not something that's solely pagan or witch related. Honestly, like every religious path practices some form of it.
Yeah.
In one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, so I mentioned Samhain, which is the pagan, the neo-pagan and Wiccan holiday of honoring the dead and your ancestors. But there are a lot of practices from all over the world, a lot of holidays where the dead and ancestors are honored. So I brought up a list of some of them. In Mexico, there's Dia de los Muertos. In China, there's Qingming. In Japan, they have Obon. All over India and other Hindu practicing countries, they have Pitru Paksha. In Catholicism, there's All Saints Day, which is the day after Halloween because they're fucking copycats. Let's be serious. But what I'm saying is that this practice of ancestor reverence and veneration is common to pretty much every culture throughout humanity, which to me says something, I don't know. To me, that says that in some way it's universally important, even if it's not important to you. It speaks to, I guess, humanity as a whole.
Yeah, and I feel like the way that it's done and the way that it talks about really is dependent on that particular culture's view of death. I mean, we've talked a lot about, in previous episodes, specifically in our episode on Dead Man Dating, like Westerners' fear of death and uncertainties in the afterlife. And I feel like that's really reflected in things like All Saints Day and the way that Western cultures and religions connect to the dead. There's like such a fear around it. I mean, how many films are there about some sort of spirit work going wrong and just like shit hitting the fan, you know?
Right. I think it is important to note, because a lot of these cultures that have festivals or holidays around venerating their ancestors, they don't tend to believe that their ancestors are either stuck in hell or stuck in heaven. A lot of them tend to believe that their ancestors are right over there, sitting on the couch, invisible, but watching everything they do. And if they are displeased with the way that you are treating the family name and the impression that you are making on society, then they will show you with some bad fucking luck. So you better light up an incense right now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly.
So anyway, wow, we really got into it there. Just because a lot of cultures and religions do ancestor veneration on a specific day doesn't mean that you have to. You know, as a witch or pagan, you absolutely don't have to wait until Samhain if this is something that you want to do. You can do it anytime. And you don't even necessarily need any materials to do some kind of ancestor connection working. But if you do want some, they're very simple. I would set up an altar with, like, photos of the dead or objects that belong to them. And some people keep altars like that all year round. We do have an altar like that in our household. I made fun of the Charmed One spell not being super intricate, but it's actually kind of perfect because you don't need a complicated spell. Your family members, your lost loved ones, they aren't here to hear you recite poetry. I mean, unless that's like your thing and they're super proud of you for it. But I mean, really all you'd need to do is just call them, say their names, invite them into your circle.
It doesn't have to be super complicated. I mean, think about movies like Coco, you know?
I love Coco. And this whole segment did make me think of Coco a lot.
Yeah, I mean, a film like that, that's a super, I mean, it's, you know, a story and it's fun to watch, but I mean, those are actual traditions that they pulled from and things that people do all the time, not just on one day of the year, for sure.
I honestly found Coco to be found watching the movie Coco to be a very spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And I would suggest to anyone who is interested in sort of a fun way to learn about ancestor veneration and especially about Mexican culture and Dia de los Muertos to absolutely watch the movie Coco, because it is beautiful and brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the blood magic part of the spell that they do, though, because it needs addressed for sure.
Yeah, I'm really not into that kind of thing. My thought on this in particular is if you're using your blood to call to an ancestor who shared this blood, why do you need to cut yourself and let it out of your body? My thinking is, like, I already have that blood flowing in my body, which is part of the doing of the magic. So why do I need to cut myself and bleed into a cauldron? I'm not about it.
I'm not a fan of blood magic, personally. I understand the practice of using bodily fluids to an extent, especially in, like, folk practices, but there's never any to self-harm.
Yeah, well, I mean, and there's a cultural difference there too, because bloodletting is a spiritual practice to a lot of other people, a lot of non-white religions, especially like voodoo. And there were all sorts of bloodletting things that happened in Native American or American Indian rituals. So I'm not trying to say anything bad about that. I'm just saying I'm a sissy and it's not for me.
No, I definitely can understand that. I just don't want someone to watch this and think, oh, if I want to work with my ancestors, I absolutely have to slice my hand open and bleed all over my altar, you know?
No, you don't have to do that. You can only do that if you really want to.
Yeah, I would not do that. I definitely, from watching shows like this, thought, oh, to work with my dearly departed, I have to prick my finger. And it was not a fun time. It got infected.
My earliest coven, when we were like pre-teenagers, and basically our Book of Shadows, our learning grimoire, was the movie The Craft. We tried to copy their initiation ritual, but we didn't want to cut ourselves. So we ended up, we had like stolen some of my parents' box wine and put it in an empty water bottle. And instead of cutting our fingers and bleeding into it, we all spit in it.
Ew.
And then we all drank it. So gross.
Ugh. Yeah, that's nasty to think about. But I mean, as an adult,
I did that shit. I did.
As an adult, I've had worse things in my mouth than someone else's spit. So
yeah, like earlier today, honestly.
You're not wrong.
Know, I'm calling you out, honey.
So, like, some common practices in working with your ancestors are just like leaving offerings for them. You could burn incense for them. A lot of people will leave food offerings, or, you know, when they make dinner, they'll like make a small extra plate and leave it on their altar. You can give them clean water, flowers, you can light candles. Some of the people that do a lot of spirit work or ancestor work that I've talked to mentioned that they really like alcohol and tobacco. So those are kinds of things that you could leave for them. There's a lot of different ways to work with your ancestors that don't have to be as elaborate as, you know, a ritual bloodletting with your sisters in your attic.
But again, if that's your thing.
Yeah, if that's your thing, do your thing.
The logic behind the kinds of offerings that people leave to spirits is that there are things about being alive, about the physical world, that they think that spirits will miss. So it's those things like food, things that smell good, alcohol, tobacco, vices, you know, stuff like that. Lit candles represent warmth and light. Those things that allegedly they don't have in the spirit world. Those are the things that people suggest leaving at your ancestral altar as an offering to them. So they can come into your home and somewhat enjoy physical pleasures they don't have anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I can agree with that logic for sure. A particular video that I watched from a person on YouTube, their name is Mint Fairy or Fairy Mint. I can't quite remember. I can't recall off the top of my head the exact username. I know that they go by Mint, as their magical name. They had mentioned like wearing your departed loved one's clothing to feel closer to them, or partaking in like games that they enjoyed, even if it wasn't necessarily your thing. Like, if your grandma really liked Scrabble, but you don't know how to fucking spell, play Scrabble anyway. You know, just stuff like that.
I wanted to bring up something that I read in a book once, and unfortunately it was once upon a time back when I was cool and went to college, and it was in a book that we used in one of my women's studies classes, and I can't tell you what the name of it was, but the idea always stuck with me. So the idea was that once you've learned about your ancestors, to apply the skills that they had in life to modern tasks that you're doing, to take your ancestors with you on certain journeys or adventures. And one thing that I'll remember is they said, like, say that you found out that your great-great-grandmother was a seamstress. Take her with you when you go to the store to buy clothes and use her wisdom to help you pick out something that you'll look great in. Say you find out that one of your ancestors was a cook. Take him with you when you're preparing a special meal to try to impress your first date, or when you're cooking for a family holiday. You know? Stuff like that. I think that that idea is really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. I actually do that already. My parents taught me how to cook, and anytime I'm making something that they made a lot or I'm making a recipe, I feel like I'm channeling a piece of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad never wrote anything down. He always just went by taste and by feel.
Mm.
And that's how I cook now. And I learned that from him. And that's something that I cherish is learning those skills from my parents in that way.
That kind of cooking to me is in itself its own kind of witchcraft.
Yeah, absolutely. And my mom, I have my mom's recipe book, and that's like one of my most cherished possessions. I mean, we didn't have the greatest relationship in life, but that's something that makes me feel closer to her.
I think it makes a lot of sense to say that there's a big space for cooking in relation to ancestor work, because I have a tradition, and it's not fancy. But when I was a kid growing up, every Thanksgiving, I helped my grandmother make cherry jello with mandarin oranges in it. And then we would cover it with Cool Whip on top. And I still make that dessert every Thanksgiving.
Aww.
As a way to honor her. Always, always.
And, you know, I kind of love this conversation that we're having. And I love that it's so casual. I mean, normally we try to have Misspelled be a little bit more structured than the rest of the episode. But ancestor work doesn't have to be like that.
It doesn't.
You know, it. And I mean, when you really get down to the nitty gritty, no form of magic has to be structured at all if you don't want it to be.
Yeah.
But ancestor work especially, I feel like that is something that should feel casual because it's your family.
You know, we talked a lot about how to connect with your ancestors. And I just wanted to get to that. You can just connect with them for the sake of connection. You know, that's all it has to be if that's all you want. But I hold this tradition true to be on any day, but this is something that we do on Samhain, is once we've called all our ancestors and lost loved ones into the circle, you can ask for their help in pretty much any other kind of magical endeavor, you know? And just literally anything. Just be like, ancestors, I've called here, support me in this spell that I'm about to do. Or you could use your divination tools to communicate with them, you know, do a tarot reading and ask them to help turn over the cards to get the message they want to give to you. It just anything. You can ask for their help with anything. However, the key difference between actual ancestor work and witchcraft and what happens in this episode of Charmed is that most likely, and if I'm wrong, you better send us an email. But typically, your ancestors will not show up immediately as flesh and blood people in your attic.
Misspelled. Melinda appears in a swirl of diamond-shaped lights that Charmed is famous for, in my opinion. I think those little swirls and twinkles are iconic.
They are, and I love them.
And she's like, blessed be.
Blessed be.
And we come to realize in the following scenes that she does not understand anything.
Not a clue.
She knows a lot about magic and witchcraft, a ton, but she doesn't know how to work a zipper. She doesn't understand how people's legs stay warm. And apparently she knows Shakespeare, even though Shakespeare wasn't imported to America until about 40 years after Melinda died.
Truth. I read that as an anachronism for this episode, and I did not want to be wrong about that, so I researched it, and that is an absolute fact.
Puritan colonies like Salem expressly forbade any kind of acting, but Prue is essentially like, shut the fuck up, nerds, let's go get some coffee.
Yeah, she has a vested interest in that. I did want to circle back a little bit. You know, Phoenix, I think that Melinda could have learned a lot from you because you know a lot about how to work a zipper and keep some guy's legs warm.
Like, I can't be mad because you're right.
Now Matthew is at a Halliwell hardware store where he just killed someone else. It's actually really horrifying. He like crucified this hardware store worker to a wall with like tools, and that's just like hanging out in the background.
Yeah, I thought that this death was pretty graphic for this show.
It is. So they don't show it happening, but you just see the corpse there in the background. And that was pretty graphic for this show. It totally was. Yeah. So Rex and Hannah show up there, and Rex is like, you have got to stop leaving so much evidence lying around when you kill people. And Hannah is like, honey, you need a makeover.
We transition back to the Halliwell Manor yet again. Again, we're going back and forth a bunch in this one. Melinda recounts her past and how she died, and she claims that she didn't use her powers to escape so that her daughter, Prudence, which is apparently a family name, wouldn't be killed as well. And Siren indicates that this is nonsense, but I'm not sure what they mean, so I would like to have them elaborate.
I don't know. I think that excuse is really lame. Okay, so Melinda can see the future, freeze time, and move things with her mind. She's basically a god. And she's like, no, I let them kill me so that Prudence would be safe when she was orphaned and left to the care of a community of witch hunters who just murder people for fun. I was like, yes, that makes the most sense. Instead of using my godlike powers to escape and take my daughter with me. Whatever, Melinda, whatever.
That's a solid point. That is a solid point. Melinda also says that Matthew stole the blinking power from another witch. But from this point forward,
I call shenanigans.
Yeah, blinking is treated as like a common warlock only power. Like every warlock has this power for the rest of the show.
And if you see someone blink, you know that they're an evil warlock.
Yeah. So like that's malarkey.
I call shenanigans.
And Melinda also reveals in this exposition dinner table scene that Matthew's gift is that any power a good witch uses on him, he can copy and use against them. That's the best fucking power ever. I mean, he's essentially, he's Rogue from the X-Men.
Yes, but in addition, once he steals their powers, their powers don't work on him anymore.
Yeah.
So that's also like a godlike power, I feel like. I feel like that should have been like the final boss power of season 8. But instead, it's just this, like, season 1 chump, and Matthew totally screws the pooch on this one.
Oh, yeah. As Siren said, Matthew is a chump and a poser and could be a lot more intimidating and powerful than he actually is. And Melinda is like, I know what to do. We are going to use this spell that is clearly in the front of the Book of Shadows to curse him in the locket again. That you could have done without rustling me up from my eternal sleep.
Yeah, just read the book that you used to bring me back.
Like, literally, they bring her back, and then, like, 2 or 3 scenes later, they're walking in the attic, and she's like, I can't believe I don't remember all the ingredients. I've been dead for too long. Let's flip 3 pages into the book and find the spell you need.
I know. I also love that they, like, use the Book of Shadows to summon Melinda, and they're like, Melinda, we have problems. And she's like, well, have you checked the book?
This might be skipping ahead a little bit, but I do really like the scene where they're looking at the book together and Melinda is just like overjoyed with how big it's gotten. And the sisters are like, what? You mean it wasn't always this thick? And Melinda's like, no. When I started it, there was only this page and the first page.
It was more like a pamphlet.
It was like a handout that we gave at our coven meetings. Like
the flyer of Shadows.
The goddess and you. But it is very sweet. It's very sweet because, you know, the sisters are picking on Phoebe and Melinda's like, these are all family traits. This book is your connection to me and your family, and it started with me. And Prue's like, well, let's hope it doesn't fucking end with us, because this guy could easily kill us, even though he hasn't yet.
I think that scene really highlights what I like so much about this episode, is because just, I don't know, more than Melinda really helps them deal with the problem, she just kind of represents exactly the connection that you'd want to feel when you were doing actual ancestor work.
Yes.
I think that's the role that she plays in the episode. Because she doesn't give them anything they didn't already have. She supports them emotionally and makes them feel good about their lineage and their legacy. Like, that's what she does. And it really, it's done well.
Yeah, it's really, really lovely. All of the, like, tender scenes with Melinda make me really emotional because that is, it's just lovely. And it's exactly what you would want. And it's something that the charmed ones need. I mean, Phoebe has a line where she says, why do worn witches lose their mothers so early? Yeah. And this is a maternal figure for them. It's a matriarchal figure that they can connect to, that they now have actual memories of. And so it's really sweet. It's really sweet. And like you said, it's exactly what you would want ancestor work to feel like. Yeah, so that was a little out of order, but we're going to go into a naked warlock here in just a second, and I'll let Siren talk about it so I don't sound like such a slut.
Well, you already sound like a slut, and there's nothing you can do about it. But I like this scene because Matthew is all, like, topless and, like, just kind of slowly pulling his pants up. And I love topless guys with long hair. And anyway, and then Matthew's all like, Hannah, check me out. And Hannah's like, even though I'm a warlock, I'm totally evil, and I daydream about killing people all the time, and also I steal sandwiches that I don't eat. I really care about political correctness and sexual harassment in the workplace. Like, she's such, like, a good office worker or something. And then Matthew is just like, God, you're boring. So Matthew's, like, putting the moves on Hannah, like, look at me, you know? And I'm, Siren is like, I will. And... And then Rex comes in and gets all jealous.
Here's the thing. I made a joke at the beginning of this episode that might be cut out at this point about Matthew's balls, but he literally talks about the clothes being too tight around his junk. So I think that his relief from being freed from the locket is very similar to the stress that he's feeling in these jeans.
So for you, him coming out of the locket was sort of like untucking.
I mean, I don't tuck personally, so I don't know what that feels like. But I've heard it's not comfortable. I have mad respect for drag queens.
So from here, Rex shows Matthew photos of the Charmed Ones and tells him to go to Quake. Even though you can teleport, Hannah's gonna drive you there. Because, okay. Also, because I'm really jealous about Hannah being alone with you, I'm going to send you guys off alone together, and I'm not going to supervise this whole project, even though my ass is writing on the line for it succeeding. I'm just going to stay here at the office and, I don't know, play solitaire.
The next scene is a scene that we talked about already. I brought it up because we were in the realm, but it's the Book of Shadows scene, and they realize in this that they can just, like, make up spells, but Melinda's like, don't be such an impatient bitch. You'll learn what you need to learn later.
Oh, you know, I also really love the part where Prue was like, yeah, Phoebe's a fucking screw-up. And Melinda was like, being a screw-uppy little bitchy slut is a family trait. And, like, that's just really the kind of support that a 90s woman needs. You know?
Honestly. We transition, again, back to the Hallowell Manor. They are all in the kitchen together working on this curse. And Phoebe's like, this is so cool. We've never done a curse before. And Melinda is like, I'm glad they're not to be taken lightly. Which, like, okay, good advice. This isn't really a curse, though. But we can talk about what it actually is when we get to the end, I suppose. So Melinda tells them that curses are not to be done lightly. Depending on what you believe in, some people believe that curses are not to be done at all. I don't particularly agree with that.
I actually think Melinda was pretty chill about it. She didn't hex shame. She was just like, you know, think about it first. But she was all gung-ho about it. She was like, oh, that motherfucker Matthew is here. He did me dirty like 300 years ago, and I'm all hex his ass.
Yes. Yeah, you're totally right. She didn't hex shame at all. And I feel like, I mean, we're led to assume that she is a Wiccan, quote-unquote.
You know, the Charmed Ones are really not Wiccans at all because they are scared to death of personal gain, but they have absolutely no qualms about using magic for violence.
So they're working on this baneful spell to do on Matthew, and they need an endangered owl feather. God forbid they substitute spell ingredients, right?
Like, nope, they have to rob a museum.
Just fucking get your feather duster out and pull a feather off of it and use that.
Or, like, I don't know, pop a pillow.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
but I wanted to talk about the owl feather a little
bit.
Yeah,
do it.
So so the owl feather is a somewhat major plot point for how this unfolds next. But they say that they need the feather of a spotted owl, which is endangered now, by the way, and that is a problem for them. However, I just wanted to bring up that the spotted owl's natural habitat is the west coast of America, such as California. Spotted owls have never lived or died on the east coast of America, such as Salem, Massachusetts. So Melinda could never have used a spotted owl feather for the curse in the first place, which means she already substituted a spell ingredient back for the spell that she fucking wrote in the first place anyway. So I don't know why she's being like a rigid little prick about it now.
And honestly, if she wrote the spell herself, why couldn't she substitute an ingredient? Because like, how did you pick the ones that you used in the first place?
Yeah, I don't know. When I am like using ingredients and spells, I just sort of jam my hand into my witch cupboard and grab whatever I can find.
Honestly, like I made two different blends yesterday and I was literally like, oh, I can use this for this thing. I don't really have the thing that I thought I would want to use, but I'll use this instead. Like, it's not hard. And it doesn't change that much.
I actually just straight up lied to you. I'm the kind of person who has my gemstones cataloged and labeled. But the point is you can use whatever you want. And sometimes I just go by feeling, okay?
Prue comes down the stairs and they're talking about how she's going to go steal the feather from the museum. Because grand larceny is the alternative to substituting an ingredient here. Piper wants to go to Quake for the herbs because they just are committing theft all over the place in this episode.
Yeah, we just steal spell ingredients from work now. Actually, I think that's really punk rock and I support it.
But just go to fucking Whole Foods, Piper.
I don't know. You know, do what any cash strapped, low on supplies witch would do and go to CVA.
Like, if you can get these herbs that you need at the restaurant, you can just get them at the store. Why do you need to go? I mean, save your money, I suppose. But, like, still, I don't understand why you had to go all the way to work to get these herbs.
I don't know. Maybe she needed saffron. I would steal that before I'd pay for it.
So we go to Quake to commit a crime. And Matthew shows up and steals Phoebe's power, but I don't really understand how. Because Phoebe's power is not really a power that you can use on someone. She just had a premonition about him when he touched her. But that's not really her using her power against him. That's just, like, kind of how her power works.
Well, I would say because she channels premonitions off of objects and people. So in that sense, okay. She kind of did use her power on him.
Okay, I can support that. I can get behind that. And so instead of killing her after taking her power, he just pushes her down and leaves. And I think the reason he didn't kill her is because the premonition that they both had was about Melinda, and he was like, oh, fuck, that bitch is here. Better go get some.
Yeah, no, I just think he's ridiculous. He could have killed Prue in the very beginning after he stole her power. He literally had her helpless, like, captive. Like, he was holding her, and she couldn't move, and she couldn't do anything. He could have killed her easily. He could have thrown her out the window instead of himself, okay? And then Phoebe, who can't even use her premonitions to defend herself, was all alone in that kitchen, which also doesn't make any sense. Why was the kitchen empty when they were clearly in the middle of a shift? Whatever. It's fine. You know, he stole her power, and then he could have killed her too, but instead he was like, I just had a vision that you specifically, that girl on the ground, were there doing a spell on me to defeat me, so I'm going to leave you there and not kill you.
He's a fucking dumbass. He's a chump. Yeah, I don't... Honestly, that super cool power wasted on him. Seriously. I mean, we talked about that from a writer's standpoint, but let's talk about it from, like, if this were a lived experience, why would the powers that be, especially, like, the source of all evil, if that's who we're assuming we're talking about as the, like, the guy that they're in league with, why would he let somebody that dumb have a power that good?
It's mind-boggling.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so Prue goes to steal a feather from the museum where she used to work, and most likely to finish the job and murder her ex-boyfriend Roger while she's there.
Maybe that's why Andy grabbed her. It wasn't about the feather. He knows that she just fucking killed somebody.
Like, you just
there.
Killed your ex-fiance, ex-boss, didn't you? And in addition, you stole a feather. And I have not even brought up yet your office windows!
Melinda is at home by herself and doesn't understand how to use a food processor or any other kitchen appliance or phones or answering machines, because they call her, they call home to try to warn her, and she's just screaming like, I'm here.
She's lost.
She's so confused. But again, she's got all of the Charmed One's powers just inside her body, and we don't see her use any of them in this episode.
Well, she has a premonition at the end, but she doesn't do anything useful.
She does have a premonition at the end, but how come she couldn't fucking see Matthew coming? She's so surprised.
Yeah. She wasn't really trying.
No, she was just there. Like I said, they didn't need to summon her. They could have gotten that spell from the book by themselves.
But I guess, so technically when Matthew shows up and confronts her, he's already absorbed Prue's power, so he can't be affected by the good witch telekinesis, I think is the logic there. And she doesn't want to freeze him because then he'll just steal the power from her.
Here's the thing, though. So Prue's not the only witch that has telekinesis. Is all forms of good witch telekinesis ineffective on Matthew now, or is it just from the witch he stole it from?
I don't know, but I mean, we're led to believe that, like, you know, the Charmed One's powers are the continuation of Melinda's powers.
So. Oh, okay. So that would make sense. But if, like, a different telekinetic witch that was not related showed up, could they use their power on him?
Well, Phoenix, I just don't know.
Well, I'm thinking about Billy from the last season, because she's telekinetic. But there's, like, a whole big to-do about the Charmed One's powers being special, but literally, like, almost every other witch in the show has telekinesis, so.
I don't know. I mean, if Billy were in this episode, she would have pulled a dagger out of her ugly-ass dorm room towels, showed up in a tacky costume, done a cartwheel, kicked Matthew right in the face. He would have been so stunned and bothered that he just wouldn't have been able to deal with anything after that point. Yeah, and then Billy would immediately start talking about her laptop, which would just make his head explode.
Oh my god, she would scribe for him on her mouse pad. It was just a point that I wanted to make. Anyway, we are about to witness an epic showdown between Matthew and Melinda, and we just really want to reenact it for you.
So for the second episode in a row, get ready for a Witch Bitches Review dramatic reenactment.
Drama. Talent. Suffering. This is a dramatic reenactment, and we are sorry.
Matthew!
We meet again.
Yes, and the sight of you still makes me ill.
Funny, the fact that I can now destroy your line forever, even though I'm not going to do anything, makes you so much more appealing.
You think I won't stop you?
You're nothing more than a dead witch, watching over stupid girls who are about to die themselves.
Go to hell where you belong!
I'm having a vision. Oh my god, you think you can curse me again? I might just kill you now. Or not. I don't know. Let me think about it first.
Go ahead. I've already given them the curse.
You're lying.
Am I?
Where's Prue? Tell me.
She's at, the zoo.
I'm going to take your words at face value, and that's where I'll kill her.
Thank God that's over.
Phoenix, it was super fun pretending to make out with you over Zoom. Let's never do that again.
Please, God, no. Yeah, but Matthew's dumb. Why would he just believe what Melinda said?
I don't know. And also, how the fuck does he know what a zoo is? She didn't know what the fuck it was.
Exactly. And also, like, he just accused her of lying, and then he's gonna believe the next thing she said?
And he's like, oh, well, clearly you're telling the truth now about where I can find your kids and kill them. All right.
Just fucking dumb. Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Yeah. Great hair, though.
He does have nice hair. He does have nice hair.
And you know, I'm okay with dumb guys with nice hair.
Same.
I'm fine with that.
Hannah has lost Matthew, and Rex is useless, but he scolds her for it anyway, even though he sat on his ass the whole time. They hint at his astral projection power that he uses in the next episode, which is closer to astral projection than what they call astral projection later.
Yeah. But basically, Hannah's like, why don't you use your new power? And Rex is like, well, because I don't fucking know how. Right, so Phoebe and Piper return home, and everyone is all still alive somehow, but they're like, where in gay hell is Prue? Meanwhile, Prue is sneaking out of the museum where she used to work, and she's just holding the feather that she stole in her hand. She's, like, been carrying it in her hand aloft, like, throughout the entire museum that she is skulking about while it's closed. And then she walks out of the museum and she's like, oh, there's a security guard. Maybe I will now hide it in my jacket that I've been wearing this whole time. Easy place to hide a feather and maybe just walk out during, I don't know, open hours, but whatever. Real smooth, Prue. But Andy is there waiting for her. Ooh.
Oof. Matthew returns to Buckland's to bitch about how he had a premonition that he could have easily thwarted, but he didn't. And Rex gives him a gun, or as Matthew would probably call it, a musket.
A musket. But also, he looks at the gun like he knows exactly what it is. Like, he's like, ah, of course, I should have thought of this. A modern gun I've never used before.
I think it would have been funnier if they pulled out, like, a 17th century musket. Right. And just, like, handed it to him. Like, they call up William from The Witch, and they're like, hey, you still got that? We need to borrow it really quick, and hopefully this guy doesn't burn his fucking eyeballs. But that scene is very short, and then we cut immediately back to Andy's car, where we could have just stayed and then transitioned into the next scene and then went into the last scene, but Charm doesn't like to do things in a way that makes sense. So they sit in Andy's car and discuss all of her crimes, and Prue doesn't admit to shit. Good for her.
Yeah. Never
don't talk to the cops.
Don't self-incriminate.
I played the fifth, and Andy's like, this is serious. And Prue's like, fine, fuck you, and uses her power to inflate his airbag, steals the feather back, and escapes.
Yeah, she's pretty hardcore there.
She really, I mean...
Everybody's, like, hardcore ACAB in this episode, I would actually have to say.
Honestly, yeah, I mean, Phoebe lied to the cops. Prue's like, I'm not telling you shit, get the fuck off me.
Prue assaulted a police officer and then escaped custody. She don't fuck around, and she did that in heels, okay? So Phoebe and Piper have almost finished the curse. All they need is that damn feather that they couldn't possibly substitute. But Matthew returns and grabs Piper and holds her at gunpoint and demands that she frees him. Because, of course, then he will have all their powers. But, you know, Prue returns in the nick of time. Matthew lets go of Piper, who he had right where he wanted her. So that doesn't make any sense. But, you know, he spared the other two for no reason. So why should Piper be left out? Prue uses her telekinesis rather cleverly, which is what I would have done because I'm also a violent person and think about how to fight people all the time. She, instead of throwing him, because she can't, she uses her power to throw things at him and to throw the gun out of his hand. Prue's a badass today.
Yeah, that was a great idea. That was, like, smart thinking for Prue.
So, you know, then they all get together and they drop the feather in the pot, and then Piper freezes him. But then they cast the curse, and Melinda says this thing that I say all the time, usually when I'm playing card games with people and I'm about to win. It's what you deserve! I love it. I love it.
I like the chant that she does, that outside of time, outside of gain, no only sorrow, no only pain.
It's what you deserve!
I love it. I love it. I think it's really cute for a curse. Even though this is not a curse. This is more of a binding spell.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, okay, so I'm not saying that he's, you know, like, unharmed by being trapped back in the locket again, which is what happens, by the way. Girl, bye. But... You know, a curse to me would be like something designed to inflict harm, to make a person sick, to give them bad luck, to make something bad happen to them, or, you know, kill them. But this is a binding spell, because especially with all four of them there, I feel like they would easily have had the power to kill him, like he's just one warlock, but instead they opt not to kill him and just trap him. So basically they're like, we don't want you to die, we just want you to stop. And that to me is a binding spell.
I mean, obviously this is not a fun thing to happen to him, but the intention is to, like, seal him away. And I mean, perhaps that's because if they used, like, a vanquishing spell or something on him, he would then become immune to that kind of a spell. I don't know.
I guess that's possible. They don't really go into why he has to be cursed.
They don't. So they just trap him. But that's, you know, that is more of a binding spell to, you know, contain a person's energy in a certain way, to keep it away from you, to keep it away from your environment, all of that kind of stuff. That's a binding. So yeah, it's not really a curse. Like Siren said, curses are a little bit more directed. They're meant to inflict, you know, this just traps him. Not really a curse.
So after this all goes down, Rex and Hannah are like, well, shit.
Yeah, they're fucked, dude.
Some, you know, ominous him will be displeased with us, which I'm assuming is gonna be the source.
I would assume so, yeah.
They, like, vaguely hint at the source throughout seasons 1 and 2 for a while before he's, like, given a name or, like, actually brought into the show. He's just some sort of, like, ominous background figure that only the bad guys know about.
Yeah, because in season two, he's, like, talked about, but the main villain then is the Triad. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's a lot of that, like, not really knowing who the overarching villain is, but the Source was a very good idea. Loved that. And so, yeah, we're gonna assume that that's who it is. Spoiler alert, things do not go well for them from this point forward.
Not so much.
I mean, they do for, like, a little bit. Like, they think they're gonna come out on top, but nah. It's not their show.
But sorry, Rex is totally a bottom.
Rex is definitely a bottom.
Such a bottom.
Also, he's cute, though, so...
A little bit. Yeah, so then, like, Andy is, like, hellbent on, like, getting a judge to issue a warrant to arrest Prue over the whole, like, feather thing. And Daryl is like, bruh, that is whack. If you call a judge about Prue stealing a feather, that judge will bitch slap you across the face. And also, you'll have to do paperwork. Like, you are dumb.
Yeah, that whole scene is just... Especially with what happens next episode, this, like... Thinking about the two of them together, this just doesn't make any sense. Because he's so hell-bent on arresting her for stupid shit in this one.
Andy is just going through a rough time right now. Like, he does not know how he feels. He has not had time to process. But, I think in a lot of season one, we're supposed to be thinking about Andy's instincts about Prue and the sisters being right. So, like, in this case, he does know that something's going on with them. He knows that they have something to do with what's going on. And he's correct, they do. But they're basically gaslighting him and being like, you're so completely wrong, even though you're actually right. And mm-hmm. in the next episode, he's on Prue's side, and she is being framed, and Andy can tell.
Yeah.
So even though it seems like he's flip-flopping, I think what really is going on is they're trying to teach us that Andy has good instincts about what's going on, even though he doesn't really know.
Yeah, Andy the witch expert is not even considering the fact that something magical is happening. Andy's like, okay, maybe my partner's right and I shouldn't do this. And we transition into the next day. The first transition in this episode that actually makes logical sense. And Piper's like, hey, Leo, you want to fuck sometime?
And Leo is like, I'd love to. Call me.
And if I had a dollar for every time I've said that today, I would have like $5. So the sisters are about to cast Melinda back into oblivion, wherever the fuck she's going.
I've watched this series probably, not even joking, 22 times and never noticed this before. Because I'm fucking gay, honey. But in this scene, Melinda's tits are out, honey. They are out. Like, that peasant top is working for her. But, so... Here's what I was thinking when I noticed that. There's no way that Melinda wore that kind of dress with that much cleavage around Salem during the witch trials. Like, really? How? Come on. And the only way that that makes any sense is if the Warren line of witches was descended from Salem's hottest, pun intended, prostitute witch. That is the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah, I had noticed the same thing. I was like, wow, her boobs. Like, as I was taking notes, I was like, first of all, I was like, why am I noticing this?
They are so good that gay men notice them, okay?
Those are some good boobs.
They are.
And I was like, they're just like, out. And yeah, what you said totally makes sense, is that Melinda was probably a sex worker, which is totally chill. Sex work is real work. Respect sex workers.
Sex work is real work, and that's not the issue.
No, it's just...
Yeah. No, I'm totally fine with that. Again, I actually think it's pretty punk rock.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah. But, like, then I started thinking about it. So, like, you know, she's wearing somewhat lewd clothing. She has no husband to speak of, but she has a child. She has the same last name as when she was born, as we'll learn in season three.
She
never married, but she has a child, and she apparently lives alone, and she can read and write, but she's also some kind of outsider that is automatically believed to be a witch at just the word of one man. So I think Melinda was probably a sex worker.
I support it. Yeah. I think it's a good theory. I agree. I that makes total sense for the time period and just like how she was dressed. Everything that you just mentioned, she was probably a sex worker.
And all I want to say about that is good for her.
Good for you, Melinda Warren, the OG prostitute witch.
Get it, girl. Get it. Get them dollars.
The charmed ones ask her why she has to leave. They want to know why she can't just, like, stay and hang out and be there with them and, like, live the life that she could have had. And I kind of have the same question. Melinda's like, oh, this isn't my time. I don't belong here. This is your time. Like, so fucking what?
Well, yeah, but then she's also like, and also they only are going to pay me for the one episode.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I guess it's a good enough reason for them to banish their ancestor back to where God knows where. I don't know. But before that, they have, like, this sentimental moment, and Melinda just, like, talks about how awesome her kids are. The charmed ones are women of strength and grace, even though Phoebe got fucking knocked down without...
Two of the three charmed ones are great.
And Melinda has a premonition about many, many more generations of Warren witches. All of them women, of course.
You fucking turf.
Fucking turfy Melinda Warren. But I mean, I guess up until that point, they had all been women. So I guess
it wouldn't make sense. Yeah, I know. I'm gonna overlook it, sorta, kinda.
I mean, I can't wait to talk about, like, what happens when Piper actually has a child and her grandmother's reaction. That's gonna be a...
Ooh, that's gonna be a whole bang thing.
That's gonna be a whole thing. But anyway, she takes Matthew with her to the afterlife so that he can't be resurrected again. But what's gonna happen to the locket? Because that wasn't something that, like, got summoned with her. How could she take it back with her?
I don't know. I just sort of feel like he's trapped in a locket that's now, like, on some sort of ethereal plane where it can never be opened again or accessed ever, and sucks to suck, Matt.
So she can take the locket back with her, but she has to put that ugly-ass fucking dress back on? Why couldn't she take the cute one she was in the whole episode and wear that back to the...
I mean, maybe Phoebe wanted it back. Like, Phoebe was like, listen, it was nice to see you, but you're not taking my fucking dress.
All right, we didn't really... I guess we did see kind of a lot of deaths this episode. Siren, did you have a favorite?
The kill of the day for me would definitely have to be any respectability that Piper's vagina could have after being compared to a crown.
You know, I normally like to do something kind of funny for these, but I think my kill of the day is probably the guy in the Hallowell hardware store.
Because it was gruesome.
That was just fucking, like, intense for this show, and it was rad. Yeah. Like,
also, think about just, like, being at work, and then some magical being, like, slowly tortures you to death with... That's, I mean, it's really awful if you, like, think about it.
Yeah, I think that's my kill of the day. That's something different for the show that we don't see very often, so I thought that was kind of cool. Kill of the day. Just to wrap up, I think this episode was great. It had a lot of really great moments. But yeah, I mean, just overall, this episode was great. I think it was well written, well acted, even though Matthew's a fucking dumbass. there was a lot of substance to this episode, and I feel like that's one of the first times that that's happened.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I also really enjoyed this episode, and as we've gone through it and analyzed it, I think that this episode is actually really a great allegory for ancestor work. It's not the way ancestor work actually goes in witchcraft, but I think there's also something to be learned from allegories and mythical, hyperdramatic representations of things. So I would absolutely include the witches back in cool representation of witchcraft and ancestor work. And also, I've had really fun doing this podcast because I've been drinking a grapefruit margarita the whole time.
You know, that might be a fun thing to start adding into the end of our episodes, is whether or not we would categorize this as an accurate or useful representation. We could start like a catalog of media that we would recommend, you know, as we're going through it. Yeah. So, yeah, if you guys would be interested in us keeping, like, a tally of things that we think are really great and would recommend for new witches to watch, send us an email.
If I were going to rate this episode, I would definitely have to give it 4 out of 4 missed chances to kill the fucking witches, Matthew. You suck.
If I were going to give this episode a rating, I would give it 2 uncharacteristically large breasts for a Puritan woman.
And 1 extremely unthoughtful missed opportunity for Leo to take his shirt off. What the fuck?
Honestly. Ugh. God. You know, I said that this episode checked all the boxes for me, but that one was missed.
That one was missed. So you can follow my Facebook page, Siren Spectacular, Non-Binary Meme Witch. You can also follow me on Twitter at Siren Spectacular, or you can watch David and I's YouTube channel, Millennial Incantations.
You can follow me on Instagram at Phoenix Arcana Lightwood. Follow me on Twitter at Phoenix Arcana _. You can follow the podcast at WBRcast across the board. If you have a question or anything you'd like to hear us talk about, feel free to send us an email at witchbereview@gmail.com.
All right, you hot Puritan prostitutes.
Keep on witching
and bitching.
Bye.